You are listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. It was almost exactly 200 years ago that David Ricardo first outlined his principle of comparative advantage that helped lay the groundwork for repealing the Corn Laws here in Britain and the free trading consensus that later emerged. But nowadays, free trade is coming under attack around the world, and since the financial crash especially, tariffs and protectionism have become the new normal. Joining me today is our head of research, Dr. Jamie White, who reminds us of the basic arguments for free trade and takes a look at where and why free trade has come under attack. Finally, he examines why there are so many common misconceptions about free exchange, with many people having a false sense that there must always be winners and losers in all forms of trade. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our podcast channel, IEA Conversations. There's the classic joke that if you get two economists in a room, you end up with three different opinions. But the economic consensus has largely tended to favour free trade for roughly the last 200 years or so since David Ricardo first outlined the principle of comparative advantage. But yet, as the latest IEA paper argues, free trade is very much coming under attack around the world. Jamie, can we first talk about where we're predominantly seeing this trend towards tariffs and protectionism?
Well, a lot of people think that it's new with Trump, and he's obviously the high-profile case. But in fact, the general trend towards freer international trade, which had really gone on from the end of World War II right through to the financial crisis, had already stopped. And after the financial crisis, so since 2008, about 1,500 new tariffs have been introduced, while only roughly 350 have been eliminated. So this trend towards protectionism does actually predate the arrival of Trump on the scene.
So many left-wingers who are normally quite comfortable about protectionism happen to dislike Trump. We've got, on the free trading side, a lot of kind of free trading Johnny-come-latelys who are suddenly anti-protectionism.
It's a bit confusing, isn't it, about what the politics of free trade are. One of the things that was very encouraging about the Labour Party under Tony Blair was that they were very pro-free trade. Britain's really always been a pro-free trade country. It's been a world leader in this area. And indeed, it's notable that the major two theorists in the area, Adam Smith and Ricardo, were both British. But elsewhere in the world, it's interesting. For example, in my native New Zealand, the centre-right party, the National Party, is pro-free trade. The Labour Party is a bit ambiguous about the whole thing. They like these kinds of trade deals, which although they, in theory, are free trade deals, they build in a lot of labour market protections and so on. And then you've got the harder right, who are currently in a coalition government, who don't really particularly like free trade at all, because they're always trying to protect domestic industries. So, the politics of it are very complicated, and they've been complicated by Trump, as I said, because Trump doesn't have any particularly coherent political ideologies, a bit of this and a bit of that. And since the left want to hate him, it really throws them off their natural game, so to speak. They don't know what they're supposed to do because they don't want to find themselves agreeing with Trump.
Yes, I think we shouldn't get too excited about the anti-Trump, anti-protectionist backlash that we're getting as a result of Trump.
Well, using taxes and government authority in order to protect jobs, which is what he's doing, right? That is a very standard left-wing kind of a policy. So they agree with Trump. I think they agree with Trump on a lot of economic issues. Not all, just some. You know, where he gets all interventionist and all, we've got to protect the great American industries and that kind of thing. So hopefully Trump will help push the left in the right direction.
Let's hope so. This trend is happening, and it's happening on a global level. What do you think is fundamentally driving this push towards protectionism?
Well, although economists have long agreed that free trade benefits both parties to the free trading and in aggregate benefits the economies of the countries that trade with, countries don't trade with each other. Individuals and companies within those countries do, but I'll talk about countries trading with each other. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
I don't really mean that.
Yeah.
The economies of both countries, you know, are improved by having free trade between them. Though the economists agree with that, it isn't obvious to ordinary people. Because, you know, sometimes in the short term it does involve costs. Take farmers in Europe. If they were to be exposed to straight-up competition with farmers from other countries, if there were no protection of them through tariffs and subsidies, they might go out of business. And they would become natural enemies of free trade and agriculture. And you can get this repeated everywhere. Steel workers in the United States don't like free trade in steel because Chinese can produce it cheaper. And so it's very, when people are thinking about their own jobs and so on, they very easily become hostile to free trade. They don't notice it when it comes to all the cheap stuff they can get. They don't think, oh, that's because we don't have barriers to imports. So you can kind of get every group to be hostile to it in their own area. And so altogether, everybody's hostile to it, if you see what I mean. So it's a, it's a political rather than economic mechanism.
So the producers and their interests are all clustered together, and the consumers who benefit from free trade are very diffuse, so they're unlikely to be as successful a lobbying group.
Right, it's a classic example of concentrated benefits to a policy and dispersed costs. So if you can protect, let's say, the steel industry, the cost of that is dispersed widely in the United States. The benefit of it is concentrated strongly in steel, or the owners of steel companies, the workers in steel companies, and they lobby hard. Agriculture in Europe's probably the classic case of this. So everybody pays a bit more for their food so as to benefit a very small group of people in Europe, namely farmers.
Jamie, can you just, I mean, I think clearly it bears repeating, why does trade leave us better off?
Well, there are two basic reasons. One comes from Adam Smith and the other one comes from Ricardo. The Adam Smith idea is about specialization, basically. Think about yourself. You specialize in something. You have a job where you do one or two particular things, and you sell that labor, and then you buy all the rest of the stuff that you want from other people who are specializing in providing those things. I mean, if you didn't have a system of trade, we'd all be subsistence farmers, right? Now, what Smith noticed was that by specializing in things, you become much more efficient in doing them. You do them better and faster. And so aggregate output goes up when people specialize in trade. It's much more efficient to specialize in trade than to all do everything for ourselves. And the larger the scope of size of the economy, the more you can specialize. You can divide labor more and more finely as you've got a bigger group of people. So
yeah, and that's why you might get an Eritrean restaurant in London, but you're much less likely to get one in Tunbridge Wells.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that's why, for things like restaurants, you need concentration of people, but for some other goods, you don't need them to be concentrated. But you want, if you've got access to everybody in the world and they can all kind of trade with one another, then you can get incredibly fine division of labor. So that's the first and the basic reason. The less obvious one is from Ricardo, David Ricardo, the idea of comparative advantage. That is a little harder to explain to people, and people often get it wrong, actually. Comparative advantage isn't that I should make what I'm better at making than you. Suppose we just make two things.
You might be better at making both things than me. Yeah,
I might be better at making everything than you.
Steady on, James.
What Ricardo showed was that it's the more efficient I am thing, that's what I should do. And it's the reason, I can't go through a worked example here, but there is one in the report, it's to do with opportunity costs. If I can produce something very valuable more efficiently than you, I should focus on that rather than the less valuable thing because the opportunity cost is less. That's roughly the idea. Now, one of the really amazing side effects of this, again, it's explained very nicely in Don Boudreau's report, is that suppose I'm trading with you and I'm making whatever it is that I make at my level of efficiency, and that doesn't change, but you become more efficient at making the thing that you make. It turns out, and it can be explained very clearly, that I get some of the benefit of that. Even though nothing's changed with me. You've become more efficient, and I get some of the benefit. Just to kind of give you a sense of roughly how it works, suppose we'd got to a situation where I was specializing in making apples, and you were specializing in making oranges. Right? You've suddenly doubled the number of oranges you can make. I haven't changed the number of apples I'm making. But you don't want to eat all those oranges. When you've become that more efficient, you want your consumption of apples to go up as well. Effectively, what kind of happens is that the comparative price of apples and oranges changes in a way that benefits me because your demand for my apples goes up. Or in other words, what you're going to charge me for the oranges in return for an apple goes down. So I start getting cheaper oranges because you've become more efficient at making them. So the benefits are shared. There's something highly cooperative about trade and kind of giving.
Those of a free market persuasion tend not to be concerned about trade deficits, of course, but it's easy to see how on an intuitive level it does seem like, you know, if you're not an economist, seems like if your country is running a trade deficit with another, you would necessarily jump to the conclusion that something must be going wrong with the domestic economy.
Well, Donald Trump in particular talks about winning and losing in trade relationships between individual countries. Let's take the United States and China. That's the most obvious example. And in Trump's view, because Americans buy more from Chinese than Chinese buy from Americans, China is winning and America is losing. To get to the essence of what's wrong with this way of thinking, you should note that, for example, take my corner store. I buy stuff from them. They don't buy anything from me.
You're running a massive trade deficit with your corner shop.
I am.
God, how shocking.
But it's not a cause of concern to me, right? Because I'm also running a huge trade surplus with the IEA. That's to say, you know, I sell my labor to them and they pay me this money. So you would normally expect in any trading, any person who trades or entity that trades, that in the individual relationships, there are going to be lots of surpluses and deficits. It's not the idea that you would have an equal trading relationship with everybody you engaged with is preposterous, right? And there's no more reason why an individual country should do it than a individual person. So looking at it in one-by-one cases and trading relationships is quite absurd. I mean, Trump is just talking nonsense here, I'm afraid. But there's another reason that people get confused about this, because they can still say, well, look at the United States has in aggregate a trade deficit. So we must be losing out in aggregate, even if you acknowledge that in individual cases it doesn't make sense. But they're forgetting that there's also another thing you've got to take into account when looking at your relationships with foreign countries, and that's not the trade deficit, but the capital account. So there's the current account where you look at all the consumables, basically goods and services that are bought and sold between countries, and that can have a deficit or a surplus on it. As it turns out, because of the way the accounting is done, if you have a deficit or a surplus on that account, you must have an offsetting or balancing deficit or surplus on the capital account. It's not just a kind of trick of accounting. There's an underlying reason why this must be so, which I'll explain briefly, if I may. Suppose people sell to Britain, or to British people, a whole lot of stuff, and we sell back less. So there's a deficit on the current account. What that means is that these people are holding pounds, right? They've got pounds. They've got to do something with those pounds, right? They've got to buy a UK asset, a British pounds-denominated asset with those. So it might be government bonds. It might be land in the United Kingdom. They might buy the shares of British companies. They've got to do something with it. The money comes back into the British economy, so to speak, in the form of demand for British pound-denominated assets. So it's not as if it's kind of gone. The money is gone. It's that it's going into the capital side of things, not the consumption side of things. There are all sorts of reasons why you can get imbalances of these kinds. So, for example, in the early days of the United States, and in fact throughout its history, people are investing in it all the time. It's got great potential. I mean, at first it was the British investing in it, right? So there's a lot of capital flowing into the United States, more capital flowing in than goods and services flowing out, because it's building up, right? People are investing in it. They're expecting future flows of goods and services out. And that's not a sign of something going wrong with America. That's a sign of people having great confidence in America. Now, it might not be that, right? You can't say in advance what's driving deficits and surpluses. But the mere fact of a deficit is not a sign that there's something wrong with your economy. It's often a sign that there's something very right with your economy. But if you listen to the way a lot of people talk about it, you would think that it was just like making a loss. It's just like an individual who's spending a whole lot more money than they're buying and eating up their savings. And it's really not a case of that at all.
It's a really important clarification. And I think this whole paper has been written at a very important time to make the case, the simple case for free trade. Because what we're coming up against is ideas which seem intuitively correct, partly because they are simple. On the surface, the trade deficit thing seems to make sense. Another classic one, I believe, is the idea of the kind of lump of labour fallacy, that there is only a very finite number of jobs to go around. Now, these ideas are simple. David Ricardo's idea of comparative advantage was genius partly because of how simple it is. I heard a great quote from an economist, I think it was David Friedman, who said that reading Ricardo as a modern day economist is a bit like a mountaineer getting to the top of Mount Everest wearing loads of high tech equipment, only to find that, you know, there's a guy in sneakers and a t-shirt waiting for him at the top. It's a genius because of its simplicity, but it's also extremely counterintuitive. We need to figure out, I think, a kind of language and a way of making our arguments that is as compelling as these kind of quite basic but also quite compelling, in their own way, ideas that we're coming up against.
One thing you do have to acknowledge is that there can be short-term costs to employees from trade. So, for example, suppose that tomorrow we did get rid of the agricultural tariffs that the EU imposes. Suppose that after Brexit, Britain went to a regime of zero tariffs on agricultural imports. I imagine some farmers would go broke. Now, what would then happen? Well, there'd be cheaper food in the United Kingdom. That would free up the income that people are now spending on food, make it disposable elsewhere. So that would create opportunities for other lines of business. New jobs would be created in those other lines of business. People would get employment there. Now, it might be true that a 55-year-old farmer may be unemployed for the rest of his life. And that is, there's no denying it, that's tough for him. This is how economies advance. I think one good way of understanding why trade is beneficial over the long run in an aggregate is to see that it's very much the same as technology. Suppose that you were a filing clerk in the 1980s. Well, you were probably put out of work by computers. You might say that's bad. That is bad. That's bad for the filing clerk. But had we put up barriers to the use of computers, we would have very much damaged the progress of the British economy.
Yeah.
Trade's exactly the same thing. I don't know who originally came up with this. The idea's going around. And it says, look, there are two ways of making cars in America. One is the way you're used to in Detroit, where there are big factories and machines and cars come out that way. Another way is that you grow a whole lot of wheat, you stick it on a ship, and you wait. And a month later, a whole lot of cars come back on that ship. Right? So you've sold the wheat to Japan. The Japanese have sold the cars back to you.
Yeah.
So, but it makes it very clear that trade promotes economic progress in the same way that technological advances do. To deter trade, because you don't want people to lose jobs over the short term, would be just as short-sighted as saying I'm going to deter technological progress because I don't want people to lose jobs over the short term.
Yeah, it's completely true. There is a sense of, I mean, it sounds like an unpleasant, unkind word to use, but there is often, I think, a great sense of entitlement with some of these industries. Not necessarily the people in the industries. Often it's commenters talking around the issue who say, well, what's going to happen to our farmers or, you know, our steel workers or whatever the industry in question is. This feeling that jobs are indefinite and are somehow the right of this particular interest group, it actually speaks to a very kind of top-down idea of the world in which we're kind of ordained, divinely ordained with a particular job that we have forever.
It's very conservative in a certain sense, right?
Yes.
So there's this idea that we've been farming in Britain for centuries. And even though other people can farm more efficiently now than the British can, the people who had an expectation that they might be farmers are entitled to keep being farmers at the expense of everybody else in the country who could otherwise get cheaper food. So there's something lordly about it almost, right? So you, yeah, all you little people must pay for my preferred way of life. I think this is actually especially acute in farming, and the effects of it are perverse because take the United States, where farming to a large extent has become very modern. You know, there are some countries in Europe and in Japan where still farms are inefficiently small and farms are kind of like family businesses, and the classic image that people have of a farm and a farming family to some extent still exists, but largely around the world and very much in the United States, farms are big mechanized businesses. And they still are in receipt in the United States of massive subsidies. These are not struggling little people scratching a living off the earth. These are, you know, people of enormous asset wealth. And they're in receipt of taxpayers' money to prop up a way of life, to prop up their rather splendid way of life. And to actually, the other thing that's really nasty about it is to think of who the competitors are who are being disadvantaged by this. They're often actually poor people.
Yes.
In African countries and so on.
Yes. So or perhaps other farmers, because often the subsidy mechanism is such that smaller farms don't get anything and bigger ones do, and this is very much the case. I come from the countryside, and lots of the big farmers get huge subsidies and smaller ones get nothing from the Common Agricultural Policy.
Right, well, it all depends on the way the subsidies are allocated. In New Zealand, before they got rid of agricultural subsidies, they were allocated on a per-sheep basis. All the farmers would have as many sheep as possible, but they wouldn't feed them as well as they could because that's expensive and it doesn't affect the size of the subsidy you get. So the interesting effect of when they removed the subsidies was that the number of sheep declined from 80 million Remember, this was a country with only 3.5 million people at the time, but it had 80 million sheep. The population of sheep declined from 80 million to 50 million, but the weight of lamb being exported did not decline at all, because they just it was worth fattening up the sheep. Yeah. The other really interesting effect, and this is another reason to be opposed to protectionism. I touched on it before, but this makes it vivid. Because you were being paid per sheep, people were farming sheep on all sorts of land that wasn't really suitable for farming sheep. Again, it didn't matter, right? You got the sheep subsidy anyway. When the sheep subsidy went away, they thought, well, I can't farm sheep anymore. What am I going to do? And it turned out that some of that land was suitable for grapes, growing grapes. And this is where the New Zealand wine industry comes from. The New Zealand wine industry was basically a response to the removal of subsidies for sheep or protection of the sheep industry. And that's, again, what you always see if you remove protectionism, because when the protected industries contract, the resources are released. Yeah. And when other people have got more money to spend because they're not paying the inflated prices, new opportunities spring up. Politicians can't anticipate what they're going to be, right? That's part of the point. And so if somebody demands, well, where are we going to get this work? Where will the new opportunities be? You as a politician have to say, I don't know, but I do know that there will be some, right? That's how economies work.
Yeah, that's a really important point. It's not just that protectionism misallocates resources. It creates different outcomes than would otherwise have been the case, and often worse outcomes. And of course, it also completely interferes, as you pointed out, with the behaviour of the protected group. There's no reason, for example, why, having seen, again, through my background, having grown up amongst farming communities, how EU subsidies have changed behaviour and made people do, quite frankly, pretty stupid things that they wouldn't otherwise do. It follows that absent those subsidies, people might evolve their farming methods. I don't think that the withdrawal of EU subsidy would necessarily have to lead to job losses. It would probably lead to some job losses, but as you said, it might also lead to, you know, new jobs, creative destruction, basically.
Well, yes. So there's stuff outside the sector, which I was talking about, but it also changes things within the sector enormously. And again, really the experience of the New Zealand farming industry should be, everybody should study it. What happened was that farm land devalued very rapidly. Many farmers went broke, but of course the farmland was still farmland, and some new entrepreneurs could afford to buy it. They moved in, they adopted very more efficient techniques, and within a very short period of time, the New Zealand agricultural sector was thriving again, but it was thriving on the basis of, you know, being actually productive and efficient, and what they did wasn't being distorted. And it was the best thing that ever happened to the industry. And interestingly, not that long after all this pain that the sector went through, almost all farmers had been won around to the system of no protectionism. There's no protectionist movement in New Zealand farming anymore, because they saw the efficiencies were brought about by having a properly competitive market.
Thank you, Jamie.
No worries.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website at iea.org.uk.